Well, good morning again for those that are just joining us and you weren't here for first service. You are joining at the perfect time. Good to have you here. Thanks a lot. And did you notice we turned the lights down a little bit?
Oh, okay. I can see. Oh, there's people in here. Okay.
Literally, somebody said the reflection up here was a lot. Literally, they said that. Could we turn those down? So I have a lot more forehead than you do. So let me back up and just tell you a little bit about the process that happens. Several years ago, the church changed the bylaws a little bit. In the old bylaws, there was always a search team and kind of the traditional classic candidacy process. Under the new bylaws, that is not required. There's lots of different ways that we could find a guy, present him to you guys. And as elders decided and looked at the process, we decided that the old way was a great way. And so we put together a search team, and that search team, I think, somewhere around 60 or 70 resumes. We Skyped with candidates. We did different rounds, and I think most of the search team is here. They can correct me if I'm wrong, but from the very first time that we talked with Daniel, we thought, this guy is the cream of the crop. And so we checked references. We checked secondary references to really try to figure out if this is the guy that God would have for us. I'm going to make sure your mic's on here.
I think.
Yeah, you're on. And so all of that process came to a day where the search team made an official recommendation and sent an official recommendation to the elders recommending Daniel Mead to be considered for our next youth pastor. And so then the elders take over the process, and in our scenario, they took over the process moving forward, presenting to the church, and this whole weekend here with Daniel. So kind of from a schedule point of view, they kind of got into town here in Hastings on Thursday. They got a two-hour tour of Hastings. I know. Somebody asked how many times did they go around.
Yeah.
So a two-hour tour of Hastings.
And still somehow missed the Bigfoot Museum. I don't know.
Yes,
how
the Bigfoot Museum, the Ammo Depot, which to me is like the coolest part of Hastings. So we'll have to do a different tour some other time. All right. So Thursday night, met with staff and spouses. Friday, looked at houses. Friday, they had a lunch thing with Nathan and Matt and I took Daniel out. Shailene, Patty, and Danny took Victoria out. Friday night with the elders and spouses. Saturday morning brunch with parents with a Q&A. And then what do we do after that? Saturday night, late afternoon with the youth leadership mm-hmm. team, followed by the youth last night, and then today. So Daniel might be a little tired, and he said his voice is beginning to feel a little frazzled. Well, for good reason. He's been talking a lot. Mm-hmm. So in this process, it's really important to me and to the elders that you guys have a voice in the process. And we don't ever want anybody to believe that this is just a church that's run by a few guys. This is all of our church, all of us together. And it's important for you guys to hear and to know. I'm thoughtful of the parents that have kids in the youth group, and I'm thoughtful of those parents who have like fifth graders or fourth graders that know in just a few years our kids are going to be in the youth group. And so it's an important moment. It's been a long process. And the design of about the next 45 minutes is for you guys to hear specifically some questions that are on your hearts. And so we received this week and last week questions from you guys, and some of them are obviously, because I know who sent them, I know kind of, you know, everybody kind of has areas of interest and things they want to know. And so this list was sent along to Daniel, I think maybe on Tuesday or Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And so he's had a chance to think about some of these answers, and we'll work through them. And hopefully we may not get to all of them, but we'll get to as many as we can. So you ready to roll?
I think so.
You guys ready to roll?
I hope so.
All right. Well, good. Well, question number one, and again, most of these we've received from you guys. And so here's the the question, first question, assuming you are in complete agreement with the Free Church Statement of Faith, are there other doctrines not mentioned in the statement that you consider non-negotiable and why?
Easy and short answer, no. I have found the older that I get, the more and more I realize there are some core, essential, absolute, die on this hill, essential things in my faith, and everything else around that I try and hold as loosely as possible, and there's a whole lot of things that we hold very loosely, but in terms of the EFCA, which was the first church that we were members of when we were married, I'm very familiar with it, with its policies and procedures and government and doctrine, and we can affirm all of those doctrines with a hearty and enthusiastic amen, and I don't think there's really anything else that we would say, well, we also need to make sure that we're on the same page or anything like that. So
you're right now in the Presbyterian church that you're a part of. Obviously, there's a difference in polity and some doctrine mm-hmm. between the Presbyterian church and the Free Church. Are any of those going to cause any friction for you guys, or would any of them be skewed a little bit from maybe where we as a church would be?
No, I don't believe so. In fact, so we're part of a denomination within Presbyterians called the EPC, which has a much smaller doctrine. They have doctrines, but then they also hold positions on certain things, and then leave it up to individual congregations to decide, you know, thereafter. So even the question of baptism, for example, leaving that up to individual churches. Our individual church happens to do both infant baptism and believer's baptism. And as someone in leadership on stage, very visible at the church, we've just been very glad that in 2 years no one happened to ask us why our kids hadn't been baptized yet. So we avoided that very well.
On, Friday, part of the time that Matt, Nathan, and I had with Daniel, we talked about different doctrinal positions, and we just point blank asked him some of those kinds of questions. What would you say of, and it's a very unfair question, but do you have a couple, one, two kind of doctrines that are nearest and dearest to your heart that our kids will hear constantly as like a thread theme through all that you teach?
I think it once you know it, once you hear it, you know, I am a for a while, I was kind of a closet Calvinist, and now I'm more open about my Calvinism and the doctrine of election and God's sovereignty and things like that. I don't know that anyone could you know pick that out and go, oh, that guy's always hammering on that. But once you hear it, you'll definitely hear that in the way that I teach and what I teach about and the way that I talk about free will. Of course, man has free will, which is, of course, subject to God's sovereignty somehow. You know, in those kinds of things. But that one in particular, just because I was raised in a Southern Baptist church that felt very differently about Reformed theology and Calvinism and things like that. And as I went through school and started to think about things for myself and dig into God's Word and say, what do I really believe that God is saying about this? That was one where I had this conversation with my parents about what I believed and how it was different from the church I was raised in, and it was interesting and one that I've really kind of taken a lot of ownership of, and so that's why I don't know if it's nearest and dearest to my heart, but it's something that I care a lot about and have thought a lot about because of the way that it was different from my upbringing.
All right, next question. Do you see a need for more intergenerational interaction in churches today? And if so, what are some things you might do to stimulate this at Hastings E-Free?
So the answer is yes, but a quick disclaimer, and I want to make sure that this is not the case. I have been to a lot of places and hear that a lot, and even the word intergenerational can sometimes be kind of a dog whistle. And what people really mean is, why can't the young people do what I want them to do? And I absolutely believe and affirm that we ought to have intergenerational worship. But if that is only ever one-sided of one generation saying, why can't that other generation do this? Then there's some, okay, we need to do some give and take and some challenges and to work some things around. For example, at our last church, this was a huge, huge thing. All the time people would see that, say this, and I'd hear this. And I worked with the youth pastor on this event. It was a missions event for the youth, and the more that we got into it and got excited about it and passionate about it, he goes, should we invite the rest of the church to be a part of this? I said, yes, let's do that. And we did that, and we provided other events, some breakout sessions, some things. Okay, the youth are doing that. I don't know that everybody, you know, but let's do this and have these times together where everybody is doing this for this missions event. And there were maybe 7 or 8 adults that showed up for that part of it in a church of 1,100 people. And that, to me, I wanted to just be like, look, nobody gets to complain anymore, because what you really mean then is, why can't the young people do what we want them to do with what we're doing? And I get that, and sometimes that needs to be the case, and sometimes we need to challenge younger people to say, you know what, this really is a whole church function, and just because it's not a youth thing doesn't mean that we can't get something out of it. But it's going to go both ways, where we say, how do we put on this thing that maybe is geared more toward youth and challenge some older folks to say, hey, this feels different. This isn't quite the way that I'm used to worshiping, but this is good, and things like that. I really, really believe that is core to our discipleship. I think intergenerational worship is a whole lot like cross-cultural worship. And as somebody that has been doing cross-cultural partnerships and involvements for years, I see the need for that. If we only ever surround ourselves with people that think like us and look like us and worship and pray and read the Bible like us and have the same experiences and cultural background as us, what we're going to do is just create a God in our image and end up worshiping ourselves. What we need is people that came from a different linguistic background. What we need is people that went through a whole different generation, a different economic crisis, a war that nobody else knows. You know, those kinds of things, to lean on one another so that together we can lean on each other's perspectives. Have somebody outside of my bubble that says, hey, this sin that's going on in your group, and you go, oh man, I never noticed that. And I think that we need that intergenerationally too. In the same way. So I really, really think that that's an important thing to be done well and to be facilitated well in the whole church. Yeah.
Very good. James, I forgot to remind you to record this. Gotcha. Oh. Very good.
Oh, it's all on tape. Great.
Yes. Okay.
I do not recall.
That's good. This would be a good time to tell everybody that you traveled and did improv for a while, and you got to watch what you say to this guy, and so he'll fit in real well with us. I appreciate that answer. Along those same lines, another question that we got specifically for men and boys, we have an active men's leadership team. We would like to be more effective in helping older Christian men mentor young men. What, if any, thoughts do you have in utilizing this type of mentoring teaching process? So similar to what you said, but a little more deliberate in the mentoring kind of sector of the church.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that we have talked a lot about this weekend. Matt, Nathan, and Scott and I talked about this at lunch the other day, yesterday morning with some of the parents. This was one of the topics that came up. I think Dietrich Bonhoeffer said that Christianity without discipleship is Christianity without Christ. And I have been so very blessed in my life, not just to have older mentors that have poured into me, but to have the opportunity to do that with younger people as well. And I really, really believe that that's crucial. The hard part is actually doing it. How do you get into that? How do you say, okay, let's go out for coffee, and what do we do after that? And it is hard. And trying to create and sort of facilitate spaces where we can do that a little bit more easily. I think yesterday, you know, I threw out the idea of what if, you know, we have this men's dinner, but the whole theme of it is discipleship and one-on-one mentoring relationships. And in the course of that men's dinner, we say, oh, and by the way, there are a couple dozen junior and senior guys in the room at these tables, and they are looking for mentors in their lives. And, you know, maybe we do it something, you know, coaching is mentoring that's just skill specific. You know, we look at somebody that's like, I'm way into cars. I'd love to get into cars. You know, there's a whole lot of people that think, oh, I don't know. I don't have the gift of teaching or pastoring or whatever else. And then we say, can you change spark plugs? Can you change oil? Can you point to the catalytic converter and bleed brakes and those kinds of things? Can you show him how to do those things and just talk about whatever else comes up while you're at it? And those kinds of things necessarily lead to bigger things about what's going on with you and your girlfriend. What's going on with you and your parents? What's going on with this school search or whatever else? And saying, oh, I remember when I... And what happens is people realize they have a whole lot more experience than they realize they have. And you don't have to be trained in, oh, how do I go through this Bible study and the packet and the week-by-week thing and things like that. There are times when we need to make those mentoring relationships a little less programmatic and just do the homework to find out who'd be a good fit, what are we interested in, and these guys will connect, let's make it happen.
So specifically then for you and Victoria, how have you participated actively in the mentoring process, and what has that, you know, specifically looked like over the years?
Sure. The very first thing that I did when I moved to Florida was I found a gentleman in the church who had done my job before. He had been a missionary before. He was on an executive team with a ministry in the area and doing different things, and had a couple of sons that he had raised and was getting ready to send out to school. And he invited me over for dinner, and I said, hey, Bruce, cards on the table. I want you to mentor me. I want you to disciple me. He had never been asked that before. I thought, are you kidding me? You are this amazing person with all kinds of ministry experience and a good, godly man. No one's ever asked you this? And he goes, well, I mean, I think I've had those relationships, but no one's ever asked me point blank. And I've learned to be able to do that, just to tell someone, I want you to mentor me, that's huge. And it feels really good to be asked that, and really valued the time that I had with Bruce and the knowledge and experience that I gleaned from him. And then having, for me as a missions pastor, having other people as they were training up, wanting to go into missions, wanting to learn how those kinds of things happened, and sort of naturally linking up and, you know, hey, let's go grab lunch and talk about what support raising looks like. Let's go visit this other ministry and talk about that, because, you know, if you're not willing to serve the homeless right here in our county, what are you doing going to Tanzania? You know, and things like that, getting to link up. I know Victoria has enjoyed the relationship that she's had, in particular with young girls in their 20s, thinking specifically of there's a couple in our Sunday school class that we've grown very close with, and they have a daughter who is just kind of at that age in life, and she and Victoria shared a lot of passions and experiences and did some similar things in school. And JC really latched on to Victoria and, you know, wanted to make an effort to meet regularly with her. So,
should it feel it feels to me like if you ask somebody to be your mentor, you have to have a level of humility to inside personally to say, I need a mentor. How do you bridge that for young men, especially, who maybe are at a point where, you know, I don't need anybody, but they do, mm-hmm. to have enough humility to say, I need some help. Mm-hmm. How do you help them, the young boys, make that connection?
Yeah. Well, I could be as concrete as possible and say, yes, you do. You know, it doesn't matter how old they are. Oh, I'm 74 years old. I don't need. Yes, you do. We all do. Every one of us does. I defy anyone to say, yes, I am the most mature believer on earth. There is no one else that can help me. No. Every one of us, I think, needs to be looking for those relationships in our life where we're looking at somebody that I say, I love the way that they are, you know, managing their business. I love the way that they are being a parent. I love the way that they're doing this, and say, hey, how do I get more around you so I can become more like you, so I can become more like Jesus? And I think that that's the heart of mentoring. It's imparting character. It's saying to someone, look, I think these things that I'm doing them because I'm trying to be more like Jesus. I want you to do them too, so that you become more like me, yes, but ultimately so that you become more like Jesus. And no matter who you are, I will fight you on it. Like, yes, you do need someone. You need a mentor in your life. And on the flip side, there are so many people that think, well, I don't have anything to offer. Well, I don't have, you know, if you are a believer in Christ, you have a more mature relationship with Jesus than a whole lot of people in your community. And there is something that you can offer somebody else. There is something that you can offer about what Christ has done in your life, how he has changed you. I used to be like this, now I am like this, and I hope one day to be like this. That's a story that's compelling to somebody else. And it's not just your opportunity, it's your duty as a Christian to be doing that. And I believe in discipleship a lot, and I think that we just need to be looking for, all right, who's my Paul? Who's that mentor who's ahead of me that's pouring into me? Who's my Timothy? Who's the person that I'm taking by the hand and walking with them closer to Jesus?
Well, as we continue down that mentoring and discipleship vein a little bit, the question is, you have a heart for discipleship, and that our youth are ready to be challenged, which is something that I had written early on. What does it look like to disciple students who are at different levels of commitment? How do you challenge as well as outreach, both within the same program?
Yeah, and I think the key to doing that is having smaller groups and even smaller sort of concentric groups where we have students that are wanting to go deeper, that have done the Bible studies and the kind of the big picture of Scripture. How do I dig in and really learn some things? And finding times to pour into those people, but not just let's have a bigger, deeper Bible study. But how do I give leadership opportunities to them? How do I take juniors and seniors in the youth group that are really, really strong in their faith, that are mature, that are starting to ask questions about maybe Bible college and ministry and things like that, and say, let's not wait until you're 25 years old to do ministry. Let's do it right now. Let's give you ministry opportunities for teaching, for small group leading, for whatever else within the context of this youth group now, and giving them opportunities as well, so that, you know, there's this sort of inner circle. You know, Jesus had Peter, James, and John that he dealt with, and then he had, you know, the wider 12, and then there was the 70, and then there, you know, and so on, to where we're always going to have students that are different levels in their maturity, in their walk with Christ, and how do we really invest well in the others, and not just then say, okay, now it's time to move on to that outer circle. No, how do I use those people in the inner circle to be a part of the outreach that we do on Wednesday nights? How do we make it so that the student coming in because they got invited by their buddy who has never stepped foot in a church before, and I don't know, they said there was foosball, let's check it out. How do I make it to where it's one of my senior guys who goes over and says, hey, I'm Daniel. We're so glad to have you. And it doesn't have to be me, you know. It's some of those students themselves that are taking that upon themselves to do it as well.
So would there be a certain kind of teen, personality of teen, interest of teen that you would connect with more readily? And would there be some that you would have a little bit harder time connecting with as you seek this discipleship kind of culture within the youth group?
Bookish nerds, really. Just I like to learn. I like to read. I like to study. I get really, you know. And so the student that's like, oh man, I really just want to do a study of the names of God and how it relates to Hebrew and things like that, I'm gonna go, all right, let's do it. And I think that's going to be natural, but knowing that, we're not going to have a whole lot of, you know, those students, and there's going to be a wide range of interests and issues, and that's where I was talking with the leadership youth leaders last night and saying, this is where I need everybody to kind of say, oh, I'm really good at this or really like doing this. I love organizing games. How do I empower them to do that and lean on others in that way? I would love to go to your basketball game. If you want to play a pickup game of 3-on-3, I'm going to hurt myself and somebody else. Things like that, where I'm going, you know what? Pastor Scott loves to play basketball. I would love to be more active, but I'm out of practice, you know. And so some of those things that I'm certainly enthusiastic and interested in, but obviously there are some areas where other people are going to be more passionate, more knowledgeable in.
So you brought it up. This was a really good question that James asked last night. What do you need? So as you look at your personality, your gift mix, your experience, you look at, you know, you don't know many of the people in the church. You've gotten to know a little bit on the youth leadership team. I thought he asked a really astute question. So what would you need from us? Mm-hmm. So as you look at your gifts and what those kind of areas you'll need help in, specifically, what will be some areas that you'll need some help in?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think an area that all of our youth leaders are going to be relied upon to do is something that I hope that I'm modeling myself as well, personal connection with students. If somebody is coming regularly and they miss a week or two, we need them to know that they're missed. Because that's what we all want. We want to be a part of a community where someone would be able to tell if I was gone. There's nothing more depressing than missing 3 weeks of church and then coming back and no one noticing. You know, we want to be able to say, hey, we haven't seen Billy in 2 weeks. Who's responding? Okay, and you've been texting in and I just wanted to let him know we were praying for him. We missed him. Hope to see him again soon. Perfect. And personal connections to where there's a big test coming up or, oh, man, I've really been fighting with my parents lately. Whatever those things are, their small group leader, those other youth leaders, you know, we're all responsible for a certain number of youth so that nobody falls through the cracks. In the, you know, where maybe I'm more relying on somebody to fill in weaknesses I have, I think one of the things that I brought up was somebody that's excited and creative about games and activities and is willing to do, you know, oh, I set this up and I had this idea and so I've constructed this, you know, watermelon launcher or whatever it is. That's probably, we're not doing that. No, we won't.
Watermelon launcher.
We've had watermelon.
We call
last
that a catapult.
Night,
so
or whatever. Just an example. But that thing where that, you know, for me, the activities are going to be, I'm going to rely on what I know, you know, from past experience, what I've Googled, what I've looked at in books and things like that. But I have been in ministry long enough to know there are people that have these unbelievable creative ideas. And they say, oh, what if we did this? And I want to empower those people to do that. I want to find those people. I want people to go, you know, what if we shoved all the chairs out of the sanctuary and we made the, you know, and that, I'm going to come up with something, watermelon launcher again. But somebody that has a vision for that and is creative enough and risk taker enough to do those things, you know, I would love to have some of those people on the team that are willing to do that week to week or occasionally, so.
So similar along those same lines, we've talked about personality traits, DIS profile, Myers-Briggs. Tell us, in those personality profiles, who are you and how does that come out in those profiles?
Sure. Well, you know, my first retort would be a flippant one of like, well, it's not who I am. And then people are like, oh, yeah, INTJs always hate being put in a box. So I have scored an INTJ. I'm an introvert, intuitive, thinking, judging. Yes, you know, on the DISC scale, I'm a high D. I think I'm like a 6 or 7.
High C.
High C. What did I? Oh, not a high D. I'm a high C. It all gets jumbled around after a while. I think an Enneagram. I think I'm a 7. I'd have to read it again. I'm not sure, but. I'm not naturally a big risk taker. I like to think about things for a long time. I like to deliberate. I like to have my quiet space where I'm really kind of pondering and wrestling with things. I also like being concrete. That's one of the things Victoria will talk about, the way that I teach or how I love to teach in a very concrete way. It's because I think that's the most helpful way to communicate. I'm also very introverted, which a lot of people don't know. I've managed to pretend for a long time. But Or just become sort of what my brother-in-law calls an occupational extrovert, dealing with people a lot of times. And it's not that I hate people or I'm sick of them or anything like that. It's just I have learned I need to make sure that I also have my time to sit down and study or think about things or pray for students by myself and those kinds of things that balance me out, lest I get worn out and burnt out.
Like in a really long candidacy weekend where you're constantly having to be on, for instance.
For example.
For example. Let's go a slightly different direction. How did you and Victoria meet? How many years have you been married? What do you love most about her? It's not on here. I just added
one. So, but you needed to mime the...
Yeah.
What I love most about Victoria is the way that she draws people to herself. She is so unbelievably friendly and hospitable, and it's not fake. It is genuine, and she loves people, and she loves hearing their stories. And there is something about her and her presence that opens people up and draws them in. I love people too, and I love talking with them and hearing their story. I don't know. I just look like an unapproachable ogre, it seems. And there's something about Victoria that people really open up to them, to her. We met at Bible school, and we have heard all of the jokes. We went to the Moody Bridal Institute, you found yourself a moody wife. All of those things, yes. We met while going to Moody Bible Institute. I was the RA of her brother, Floor. She met me wearing socks with sandals and cut-off jean shorts and a nice tie-dye shirt, and it was love at first sight. I asked her out on a date to be a good example for the guys on my floor that I thought you should be asking girls out on dates a little bit more. It was like my pulpit. I was like, we go to a school with the most beautiful, creative, funny, godly, wonderful, loving women on the planet. Why on earth don't they feel like it? Why on earth can't we make them feel as special as they are in the eyes of God? And I said, I'll take this girl that you all have been chatting about. Oh, she's so cute. Oh, I'd love to ask her or whatever. You know what? Her. I'm asking her out on a date just to show all of you how it's done. And then I married her. So, I asked her out on a date to set an example, and then I wound up falling in love. So
how many years you've been married?
We've been married almost 10. It'll be 10 years in January.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Three little kids. I think Fielding kind of... Okay, so we got to tell the story yesterday. Fielding was the cute one if you're in first service up here talking the whole time. But last night, Cassie, the other one, Daniel's teaching along to the youth, and Cassie, his four-year-old, is heckling him. It was awesome. And he was sitting on Anna's lap, and at what point, he was talking about the story of Joseph, and he said Joseph's brothers were snot bags. Guess what the little four-year-old heard? This is a new word. I got to start saying snotbag. So he says to Anna, he says, will you get me something to drink, snotbag? Funny story. It's true.
He's going to love it even more when I tell it at his graduation party.
Yeah, and he had a revelatory moment in the middle of that. He was talking about this sex question, and all of a sudden he's like, my four-year-old's listening. So 10 years, three little boys, lots of energy.
Yes.
So very good. Mm-hmm. The question that came along with that, you guys you served as a missionary as a single man, and then you guys served together in Germany, right?
I, as a single guy, I was in West Africa at a school called Sahel Academy. And then after we got married, we spent some time at a school in Germany called Black Forest Academy, and then went back to Sahel Academy in West Africa.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what have been a few life lessons you learned as a missionary?
Well, one of the biggest ones, and the reason that we are here and not in Germany or Africa, is an older guy in our, he was our member care point person, One of the things that he would talk about is the evangelical syndrome, this idea that we get so puffed up in ministry that this work is so important, it's the most important thing in the world. If I wasn't here preaching the gospel to these people, if I wasn't here planning this church, if I wasn't here translating the Bible into this language, no one else would be, and the kingdom would perish. I mean, it's integral that I'm here. This is the most important thing. And he would say, no, it's not. Know this, whenever you think, well, who else would do it? The answer is someone else will. If God really wants the work to happen, he doesn't need you to do it. He will raise up someone else. But no one else can be a husband to your wife, and nobody else can be a father to your children. And so you better believe that that has to be your first priority. And for me, some things happened while we were in Africa. There was a flood, and the campus had to be evacuated. It was underwater, and you would be amazed even what this much water can do. Of course, I'm talking to a bunch of Nebraskans about flooding. Given the events of the last year, I'm sure you understand. And I was like, no, we're going to weather this out. We're tough. We're hardcore missionaries. We can do it. No, let's help rebuild. And it was sort of slowly killing my wife. And I think it was the sixth time, maybe, that she asked, I need to go back home. It occurred to me, yeah, I cannot ruin my relationship with my wife at the expense of this ministry that I have. And that was really hard for me. I felt like a failure. I felt like I was a failed missionary. And yet I've never once regretted the decision. I've never once regretted coming home because that's what my wife needed. And I know that that's you know, there's a reason that we're here together. There's a reason that we're here with our boys because, number one, this isn't just my ministry. They're going to be involved in it. As Scott has shared, my boys will certainly be involved in what I'm doing. But also, too, I think that you all know, and from what I've seen in this church and the families that I've met, that it's a value, and you know my family is going to come first, and this has to fit for them, too. And for me, I would be a huge hypocrite if I was talking to my students about being honorable men and women of God, and I wasn't treating my wife and my sons the way that God has called me to. And so one thing that I know in my time as a missionary was family comes first, and I need to be a husband first. I need to be a father right after that, and the ministry will happen after that. And so... I think that's one of the biggest life lessons that I learned as a missionary.
Very good answer. Probably got you a few brownie points, too. Just saying. She's like, we got this on recording, too. It's your new ringtone on your phone. I know it. Here it is.
Family first.
All right. Another question that we received. It's a little bit longer, but I think it deals with some of the lessons and interests coming out of Boys Town. There has been a dramatic rise in mental health conditions and suicide among children and teens in recent years. One author cites 7 reasons why teens with common mental health conditions don't go to church or fully participate in activities or programs offered there. Stigma, anxiety, self-control, sensory processing, social communication, social isolation, and past experiences in the church. Have you dealt with kids struggling with these kinds of mental health conditions? And if so, how can we be more effective in reaching and helping kids who suffer this way?
The answer is yes, I have. And one of the things that I really feel like there is this wonderful marriage between what we did as missionaries and the way that we ministered to youth at Boys Town. The heart of cross-cultural ministry and cross-cultural relationships is interacting with people that are different than myself. Not better than, not less than, not anything, just different. And understanding people approach the world and see life differently because we have different experiences, we have different cultural values, and it's just different. And I would, every single day of my job at Boys Town, look at some 17-year-old kid and think to myself, didn't anyone ever teach you this when you were 4 years old? And the answer is no. No one did. And there are a whole lot of ways that they were there because of the choices that they had made, but more than anything else, I saw in them the result of somebody else's choices. I saw in them broken homes, one-parent relationships, parents that struggled with addiction or chronically in and out of prison and things like that, that affected them too. And I think to myself, I did not choose my father and neither did they. And here's my opportunity to level the playing ground a little bit. And I, you know, no one taught you this when you were 4 years old. So now I have to do it when you're 17 and it's a little bit harder. But being able to see people and being able to take a pause, suspend judgment for a little bit and consider where they're coming from, I think is one of the biggest values that we can have in ministry. And getting students to see not everyone is like you and not everyone has had the parents or the upbringing or the church family that you have had. How do we look and see other people? How do we look and see somebody else might have a mental, medical, whatever condition that is different than me that I don't understand? Oswald Chambers said, there is always one fact remaining in every man's case about which we know nothing. There is always something else when I'm interacting with somebody. There's always some part of their story that I have no clue about. There's some interaction that they had with their father or the fight that they had with their spouse this morning or the really, really hurtful thing that their boss said to them this week. There's always something, some piece of the puzzle that I'm missing, and I have to always approach it knowing I don't know everything that they're going through, so I have to operate with a little bit of grace and forgiveness. And I think that if we can instill that in our youth as well, if we can teach them to learn, to learn about people and say, okay, what's different? I don't have to immediately think if something is right or wrong or better or worse or anything like that, but what's different and how is it different and why is it different and how is that affecting the way that you act or read the Bible or perceive the world? I think we do really well with that. And it's the same thing when somebody comes in having struggled with anxiety their whole life and being able to just take a breath and learn more and try and figure out how is it that they're seeing the world. This thing that I don't think is a big deal is a huge deal to them. And so I need to treat it like more of a big deal and value that. So things like that. I don't know if I answered I rambled for a little bit, but hopefully I answered the question or somewhere.
It's been known to happen on this stage. All right, so let's go a slightly different direction. Most recently, you've been a missions pastor.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked several times, including this morning on the stage, about how much you've missed working with students, mm-hmm. and that has kind of led to seeking a different position in church work. That came on the heels, in a very strange way, of some changes in your church and ministry in Florida. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the very first thing that prompted us to start looking for jobs elsewhere was a really unhealthy church environment where we're coming from. There's something of a, I would call it a leadership crisis in the church. I've learned after the fact in bits and pieces that there are, a lot of repeated behaviors and patterns and things and people that have left. But even in my tenure at the church that I'm at now, we've had several staff members leave, and several even in a row. And so in the course of this looking elsewhere and dialoguing more with a former colleague who was the youth pastor at one time and finding out how much I love working with youth and the opportunities that I get to work with youth and how much I enjoy them and realizing this was the direction that I wanted to go in and maybe this is what God had for me all along. In the span of the last several months, there's a number of events that have happened. We had a pastor who retired who told us that as a staff in confidence, basically, I'm just tired of fighting, with the other pastor on staff, and I've really had enough, and I just need to retire. He's 56 years old and retiring, and the congregation went, wait, huh? Retiring? Really? And some people asked questions, but, some people didn't. Week after that, we had someone resign her position. Several weeks after that, one of my best friends, the former youth pastor, he resigned. And that was really hard for me. That was unexpected. That was a big kind of shock in the church. And in the wake of that, there were some pointed questions that were asked, and I was bold and gave some honest answers, maybe too bold, maybe too honest. And right after getting back from a mission trip, the day, you know, the morning that I got back into the office, I have bags to unpack and everything. You know, a couple of members of the personnel committee came in and fired me, essentially. So I am currently unemployed. And I don't for a moment regret the things that I said or the reasons that I said what I said and the concerns that I had and raised. And in that time, about 2 weeks before our associate pastor resigned or retired, I had I'll call it a vacation planned, used vacation time to do it, to go and visit a buddy of mine in Costa Rica who runs a youth group and was doing a camp and had asked me for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years in a row to come and be the speaker for this camp. And I had kept saying no, and so I was like, yes, I'll do it, and came and was the camp speaker and just loved it. Like, had a great time with these missionary kids, mostly, in the youth group, and had a blast and loved that. Then in July, the trip to Brazil was something similar. We did an English camp. I was leading a team to teach English for teenagers in Brazil. And then I was the speaker. And same thing, just talking about life and preaching through the week and then getting to teach English and you know, interact with kids and be kind of goofy, fun Daniel for a week at camp was just a lot of fun. And so those things happening sort of simultaneously with, you know, my job breaking down, realizing, man, I would really love to be doing more of this. And I really think maybe this is the direction that God is pushing me. And when I have told other people, yeah, I have this possibility, it's a youth pastor position up in Nebraska, and almost exclusively people have said, thank God, I've seen you and what you're doing, and you really need to be working with teenagers. And so that's been really just affirming and encouraging for me. So
what is interesting in this process is when we start working with Daniel, I don't know, it must have been 3 months ago or two
about,
or a long time ago.
2.5 months about, yeah.
So we track along with them. You know, he was part of the mix and a bunch of different candidates, and we're going through, I think we had three that we were moving forward with to go to Skype interviews and all of that. Well, we knew nothing about what was going on at the church that he was working at. So we get to the point that we say, this is our one guy. We're making the recommendation to the elders. I think it was the very same week that the recommendation went to the elders. Daniel has to call me and go, I was fired. And so I'm sure that was hard for you. But then what it did for us is we on the search team, we had to decide, what do we do with this? And so I asked Daniel for some names of people that I could call, kind of secondary reference and almost tertiary references, and say, hey, what can you help me understand about what's going on at the church? What's going on with Daniel? How do we understand this? That led to a conversation with Daniel where I had to ask him some things like, do you have a problem with authority? Are you going to struggle working in a multi-staff environment? And what's really interesting, in one of the conversations I had with one of the references who knows Daniel very well, part of what he said was, what ultimately led to this for Daniel was the scenario of, sometimes you have to do what is right regardless of the consequences. And it was maybe what I would call an affirmation of high character that ultimately led to this decision by the board that says, hey, if you're looking for other positions and you really want to be a youth pastor, then go do that. You're obviously not supporting us and all of that. It's really, what was behind that was this character, this high calling that he felt within himself to do what is right, to do what he thinks God thought God wanted him to do, that ultimately led to these conversations and led to the termination. So I came away from those conversations with those other references even more excited about this guy that we kind of almost accidentally found down in the Everglades with the crocodiles. But my point is, we did extra work to try to figure out what is behind this, and as we kind of polished that stone, it shone even more brightly. And so I wanted you guys to know that. And that's interesting because in the packet that we handed out, it says in his resume, you know, missions pastor 2000 whatever to present. Well, when we printed that and handed that out, it was true.
That's, yeah.
But that, there's been a change. Just a couple weeks ago was actually when this happened. Let me ask you two quick questions, okay, and then we'll be done. And it gets us through the list. One question, in the information provided to us in the packet that I was just talking about, you mentioned holistic several times. Can you explain what you mean by holistic?
Sure. I think sometimes we think about ministry in a very one-dimensional way, and especially when dealing with teenagers. What's the old axiom? You know, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. If I'm not willing to say, how are you know, what are you into in your life? You know, if you want to be a better basketball player, I hope that I can be supportive of that too. It's not my area of expertise, certainly, but how do I come to your games and cheer you on? If you are wanting to be better at doing outreach, I think that's integral too. But you know, doing ministry is not just about teaching. It's not just about me saying, here's what the Bible means and here's what you should do. It's me being able to say, here's what we should do. Now let's go and do it together. Let's practice together. Let's watch. Let's talk about the things that you want to talk about. I want to hear about the things that you care about. And it's more than just about your spiritual health. It's about your emotional health. It's about how when your physical health is ailing, you know, that's one of the big jobs of a pastor, going and visiting people, because all of those things are intertwined. Because when things aren't going well at home, that bleeds into the way that I read the Bible or the way that I pray. And when I am not reading my Bible or praying or hanging out with other believers, that affects the way that I'm a student or an athlete or a whatever. And I think all of those things are connected. And so that's why I say holistic care, because I never want to give the impression that, you know what, I'm just the Bible teacher guy. That's what I'm good for. You want a verse, I'll give it to you. Anything else, you got to go and talk to somebody else. I want to be there, and I want to care about the things that students care about, in whatever capacity or arena that is.
All right, last question. We have a multi-staff here at HEFC with different ministry areas. How would you describe yourself? And maybe it's the your style of collaboration is kind of what they're thinking, but how would you describe yourself as working within a team framework? How do you see yourself working collaboratively with other leaders and ministries?
This is one of the things that excites me so much about coming to HEFC, and is really, I think, missing in my ministry in Florida. I want to be doing more of that, and especially within the church, sometimes we can get into our little silos, and you know, the reality is, you know what, if we shape the way that our kids are learning and what they value and how they are getting prepared for what's next, the youth group is what's next in a lot of ways. And how do I take the baton and keep rolling with that? If I say, man, I'm seeing so many 6th, 7th, and 8th graders coming in and they don't know squat about this, or man, they've really got a healthy value for this. You know, that's something that Nathan and I get together and we say, yeah, how do we do more of this or do less of this? Or, that's fantastic. Let's keep going on that. And do some of those things and help me to pick up there as well and say, well, you know what? I think we're trying to teach this thing too late in their lives. Can we fit this in earlier in children's stuff? But also, too, it's wider than that. If, you know, Scott says, I want the whole church to read through the New Testament in 2020, I want to say, you know what, the youth is a subset of the whole church. I want to be a part of that too. How do we do that geared towards teenagers? How do we do that in a way that is contextual, that makes sense, that is real life application for them, but still makes them feel like We are all part of one church doing this together. And mom and dad and kids can talk about this together because we're all reading through 1 Peter at the same time or whatever it is. Likewise, music and missions, you know, music is not just for the people that are musical. We all are singing this morning, some of us more loudly than others, you know, but like, and missions is not just for the people that are interested in missions. You know, it is not the great suggestion, it is the great commission. We all are called to do that, whether you are 13 or 38. Like, and how do we as a church interact together and do more of those kinds of things? That's where the question of intergenerational worship comes in as well. And I'm excited to do some of those things. I'm excited to say, hey, here's how this youth event can fit into the broader theme of what we're doing this year. Here's how this outreach opportunity dovetails really well with this teaching campaign that I'm doing. And I really want to make it so that I have a great push to get involved in this outreach opportunity. Yes, even for our young people. And so I'm really looking forward to collaborating. That was where I found so much just really neat growth for me in professional development in ministry. And I'd love to do more of that here as well.
All right. Well, our time is up. Thank you for your answers. Thanks to everybody who submitted questions. Very thoughtful, very good questions. Are you tired of answering questions? I mean, over the last like 15 years. Surprised you're not drooling and just kind of being done.
Well, there's a lot of overlap, so I now have my stump speech and
yeah, that's good.
Kind of canned by now, but no.